You're listening to the Greening Out podcast. This show contains profanity, hate for the state, and themes of a libertarian nature. If you are easily offended, please listen to something else. For more, visit greeningoutpodcast.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Katie Green.
Hi, I'm Dan Green, and welcome back to the Greening Out podcast. Now, tonight we are talking to Keir Martland. Keir is the Director of Youth Affairs at the Libertarian Alliance. Keir, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Keir, for anyone listening who might not know, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with the Libertarian Alliance.
Oh, okay, that's a nice question. I started off in the Conservative Party in my local youth branch, and I set up a branch for Wigan, which is my hometown. And then within a year, I was running more or less three branches. Anyway, I soon realised that the Conservative Party is not a home for libertarians, and so I left. And as for how I've sort of gone into libertarianism at such a young age, well, it's just a matter of stumbling upon the right books. And the internet seems to have made that much easier than in the past. And yes, the internet has also made it much easier to find other libertarians. In the past, you used to have to find them by actually going to physical places. And now you just go on the internet and search, you know, libertarian groups or whatever, and you find them quite easily.
Loads.
Yeah. And so that's sort of how I got into the Libertarian Alliance. I was editing a webzine called The Libertarian for some time in 2013, and I did an interview series of all kinds of libertarians. So there was some American ones, some English ones, some European ones, and the first person I interviewed was Sean Gabb, and that's how I got sort of interested in his particular brand of libertarianism, I suppose.
Are you talking about the kind of, like, would you say you're more of a classic liberal?
No, in fact, me and Sean actually have a bit in common, but not much. The only thing we have in common is we're incredibly anti-establishment.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing to bring people together sometimes, which is quite, you know, it's weird because it's so individualistic, but it can bring people together. On that note, do you think it's becoming more popular with younger people? Do you think individualism's kind of coming back as opposed to collectivism?
Oh, the economics of it is definitely, you know, taking hold on the minds of the youth. If you were to ask the average person my age or a little bit older or a little bit younger for the arguments for and against communism, then there would be they'd be hard pressed to find any arguments for communism, I think, on the whole. And so, yeah, in that sense.
Well, not in Glasgow. In Glasgow, you.
Yeah, perhaps not in Glasgow. But,
over here, we've got all kinds.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't think there's a majority in many places that that the youth are on the whole in favour of state socialism or something like that. And so the economics of it, we seem to have made a lot of progress, especially over the last 30 years, which is largely, I think, due to the work of people like Sean Gabb. And so, yes, we've made progress there, but the illusion, I think, holds sway that we do have a capitalist system and that we have, to a large extent, a libertarian order anyway. And so, yeah, there is quite a great deal of laxity, especially in terms of not economics, but things that you'd call social policy, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know something, in fact, this would be interesting to see what you say, because one of the first things that the first time we interviewed Sean Gabb was we said, well, what do you think some reasons are, you know, that there isn't, like, sort of more libertarians, you know, in the UK as a whole? I mean, what would be your thoughts on that?
So, you know, So you're asking me what's the reason that...
Well, maybe some of the possible reasons, like why libertarianism, for example, isn't so popular, you know, in this part of the world as, you know, as compared to, say, the US or something.
Yes. Well, we're a small country and I think there's only enough space, really, for a few sort of institutes and certainly only one movement. If you see what I mean, there's only so much space in one country, certainly a country of our own size, for one movement. And that movement seems to me to not be the hardcore, to be representative of hardcore libertarianism in this country, but representative of what you could call you could call it Thatcherism, you could call it neoliberal economics, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So the libertarian movement in this country is, you can take two different views of it quite easily. Mm-hmm. There's no simple answer, but many in the Conservative Party will tell you that all is well and that it's only a matter of time before a fully fledged libertarian prime minister is elected. society. This illusion holds sway in conservative future. I don't doubt that many in the various affiliated think tanks, I don't think I need name them, will tell you the same. These organizations tend to talk at length about how immigration benefits Britain, how we ought to cut the top rate of income tax by 5% or 10%, how we ought to legalize drugs. And maybe not legalize all of them, but how we ought to legalize and then tax and regulate drugs, how we ought to liberalize the banking sector, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things you'll hear from most people who call themselves libertarians in this country. Yeah. Another common theme is a tendency to talk about the state in the way that Milton Friedman did. And so let me explain. Milton Friedman saw the state as the great do-gooder. He would always speak of the state as being well-intentioned, yet sort of on the whole rather dumb. The state wants to increase the general welfare, and so it passes Regulation X, which actually harms the people it was intended to help. And that's the refrain of most of the libertarians in this country and in America, but America has a very strong minority of hardcore libertarians. Mm-hmm. The Libertarian Alliance, I would say, is the sole representative in terms of think tanks of the hardcore libertarians in this country. While there is a great deal of divergence, as I said, even among the board or the committee, whatever we call it. For instance, Sean is a sort of... I don't know what to call him.
There's not really a word, is there?
In the tradition of someone like John Locke or John Stuart Mill, while I'm a Rothbardian. Mm-hmm. Even though there's divergence among us, we at least recognise that the state is not some naive do-gooder. Mm-hmm. We know that the state is not analogous to a doctor who accidentally kills every one of his patients. But instead, the state is analogous to, say, a rapist or a murderer whose only mistake, so far as it is concerned, is getting caught in the act. And so, yeah, this is a very roundabout answer, but I think the libertarian movement in this country and on the whole, the world over, it can be said to be divided between the naive modal libertarians and the hardcore, what you could call paleo libertarians. Mm-hmm. The former are doing very well in the establishment and in the think tanks and in the youth wing of the Conservative Party in particular, while the latter are a very rare breed.
We're sort of mentioning a lot of the libertarian movement, you know, like in the US as well. And from the kind of, say, if you take the kind of podcast sort of popular end, as opposed to like the sort of more academic end, I've noticed and I've heard people describe it this way as it's like having growing pains just now because there's become a lot of sort of, you know, infighting amongst certain people. You know, because some people now in that movement have become quite controversial. Mm-hmm. Is that anything you've been kind of keeping an eye on, or do you not really sort of keep an eye on that end of things.
Yes, I do see a lot of infighting in the libertarian movement, and it's largely, I think, due to sort of the leftists in the movement trying to create conflict within the movement. If they weren't already quite rich and quite clever people, I would guess that they were put into the movement by other people to break us up. So I do see a lot of infighting, and I would put it down largely to leftists. At the moment, the like I said, the big source of infighting is over whether we should be thick libertarians or thin libertarians, and the very terms thin and thick were actually coined by the people who call themselves thick libertarians themselves, who are leftists, who attach on top of libertarianism a kind of social justice ethos, I suppose. Yeah, so infighting isn't good.
Obviously, yes.
But it doesn't seem to be an organic thing. It seems to have been sort of forced on the movement by some interesting people, let's say.
Are we wearing tinfoil hats? We're not going that far. But no, because we can point to actual, you know, infiltration and people being placed into things all throughout history. Even Emma Goldman wrote about it in Anarchism and Other Essays way back in the 1910s, I think that was.
Yep.
So we can see stuff like that happens. But it's interesting you say that. So you think it seems more like people inserted as opposed to a sort of, like I said, a sort of maybe more of a sort of growing pains as it sort of expands out?
There seem to be a lot of people in the movement who are using the term libertarian, who don't merit the term libertarian, and who seem to be using infighting, who seem to be causing infighting in order to, I don't know whether it's to get attention or whether to try to redefine libertarianism in a way which is simply uncalled for. I don't know, but I haven't seen any productive infighting, and it seems to me to be caused by people who want to change it. You know, there's the saying, if it isn't broken, don't fix it. And that seems to me to encapsulate what the infighting is at the moment. You know,
I've actually heard a lot of other issues being dragged into libertarianism quite a lot, you know, and it seems that everything, like, instead of just people talking about something kind of simple and streamlined, we've got to the point where people bring, and I kind of want to be careful with what I say, but people bring other aspects like parenting and things into it, you know, and if you know what I'm talking about.
People get a bit preachy.
I think, and they bring all these other aspects into it that I don't think belong, and, you know, if you're just saying, you know, if you're just talking about being in a libertarian sort of movement, I use movement in quotes.
I don't really like the word anyway.
I don't like the term movement, actually.
Well, we aren't a movement in England, I don't think. We have, like I said, the prevailing establishment kind of libertarianism. But as for hardcore libertarians, we're no more than a circle, really. We can count most of them on two hands. People who are sound libertarians, I think. But going back to attaching things which don't need to be there, yes, it would be wonderful if people brought up their children better, or simply didn't hit them. It would be wonderful if that led to people being libertarians. But I don't think that's going to happen. I remember watching a panel session at the Property and Freedom Society on their YouTube account, I think it was. And someone put this question firstly to Hopper, as in Hans Herman Hopper, and then also to Anthony Daniels. And they both just laughed. Laughed hysterically, and they both said, "Well, we were both smacked as children. What's your point?"
Well, Dan and I often say we were both smacked around and we turned out just fine. But, you know,
not that we condone before people start going on the comments section and losing their minds. Not that we don't. Right.
I don't actually believe I wouldn't do it. But I'm not a parent. See, I can't really talk about it because I'm not.
But so then if we're talking at this country and we're talking about leftists, a lot of people talk about media bias and, you know, like some people say you're paranoid, some people say you're not. Would you say there's a sort of left-wing media bias? And if so, would you say like that also has an effect on how people think in a political way?
There might be a left-wing bias, but the main bias seems to me to be it's essentially an establishment bias, and the establishment isn't leftist in the old sense. The establishment is leftist in the modern sense, in the sense of being politically correct. Mm-hmm. However, the standard sort of cultural Marxism narrative, I think, breaks down sometimes, because if you look at the way I think, this is my own personal view, but I think that the coverage that the BBC gives to Muslim groups has become steadily more anti-Islam quite recently. And this would sort of go counter to the politically correct, to the cultural Marxism narrative. And so I don't think it's as black and white as that. What I think the media does is it lives off fear, essentially. It isn't just there to pander to certain groups. It's there to create a climate of fear. And certainly over the last year that it has succeeded in doing that. People are terrified of what they see as Islamic extremism. They're terrified of all these different things which may or may not be
actually happening. Worth
being, yeah. May or may not be justified. And another one, which is a non-human one, was the Ebola crisis.
Oh, gosh.
Everyone was terrified. Everyone was absolutely terrified.
I met quite a few people who were really, really scared, like genuinely scared of that.
Yeah.
It's funny because I work in a pharmacy. It's just weird how anybody would be scared.
And so the media, while they may hide some truths from people for the sake of putting forward some kind of politically correct message, mm-hmm. that they also seem to really exaggerate some truths or completely create truths, mm-hmm. what they want people to believe is true, for the sake of creating a climate of fear. And so that would be my explanation of the media. Rather than being a sort of left-wing bias, or rather than political correctness, I would also say that they tend to play on people's fear.
Yeah, and it's funny how sometimes you can see, like, it seems there's been almost a concerted media effort to sort of make UKIP look like, you know, the devil and all his pals, but it doesn't seem to be working in practice. You know, obviously we can say what we want about by-elections and things. People say, oh, they're just rebelling, we'll wait till a general election. But what's your thoughts on UKIP in general, Keir?
UKIP were very good for about 20 years, and over the last year, they stopped being good. That's my simple overview of UKIP. For 20 years, from about 92 to 2012, I think 92 was when they were formed, they were a kind of libertarian party, mm-hmm. and they became progressively more libertarian the more unlibertarian the Conservative Party became, because they knew that they weren't going to that the Conservative Party wasn't going to be their platform, and mm-hmm. so they were quite libertarian, and they're also quite politically incorrect, because they were largely made up of aging men who tend to say whatever comes into their head, like Gottfried Bloom, for instance.
That's a good example.
Low filter.
I don't think he would like me calling him aging, but I've said it now.
We're all aging here. We're all aging.
Exactly. So UKIP for 20 years was made up of people like that. Nigel Farage, for instance, he's a UKIP veteran. I don't know if he was there from the very beginning, but he was certainly one of the first UKIP candidates for the European Parliament. And these people, whether or not they call themselves libertarians, they had libertarian inclinations. They didn't like the European Union, not because it costed us money, not because of certain neoliberal arguments, but because it's because of the threat it posed to the ancient constitution. And so they were quite conservative and quite libertarian. So that was UKIP for 20 years. But UKIP over the last year, or maybe 18 months, has progressively become a very broad church, made up of increasingly of people who've not voted for a long time and people who used to vote for the Labour Party in the 1970s and the 1980s. And so you have in UKIP now, oh, and also those two Conservative MPs who defected.
Yeah, Mark Griffiths and the other one. Douglas Carswell, yeah.
Yeah, I would have thought he would become the Conservative leader after David Cameron.
Did you think so?
Yeah, that was my guess. But anyway, UKIP is now made up of three distinct groups of people. On the one hand, you've got the UKIP veterans, who are quite anti-establishment and largely libertarian. You have the influx of Labour membership, who are state socialists, and the only common ground that they have with the libertarians, the quasi-libertarians, is that they're against mass immigration. They're against the European Union. And they might be a bit racist, I don't know. And the other group are those two Conservative MPs. They don't seem to mesh. They don't seem to fit with the other groups in any way. They are, I think they're both from the 2005 intake of Conservative MPs. They are the most establishment people you can get. And so UKIP, I predict, will have to split this year once Nigel Farage steps down, which I think he will. UKIP will have to split into the old-fashioned members, which might still call themselves UKIP. They'll have to split into a state socialist party, which is largely also Eurosceptic, and they'll also have to find somewhere for those two Conservative MPs.
Well, you're talking about obviously Douglas Carswell and Mark Reckless that defected, and why do you think they did that then? Because they could probably lie and say it's ideology, but we know all politicians are playing a game. So do you have any thoughts as to why you think they did defect?
No, I won't say there's any kind of conspiracy, and I don't think they're going to get anything. I don't think they're going to think that this was in their self-interest. Mark Reckless, from all accounts, is a bit weird. Of course, they would say this, but when Mark Reckless left the Conservative Party, there were lots of anonymous sources which said that he was pretty iffy, and he had no social skills whatever. And I suppose you can also get this from just watching the videos of him. He does seem a bit awkward, and so he might be a bit unstable. I don't know.
Aren't we all?
Yeah.
But it seems to me then, so that's kind of what you're saying as well. It's like UKIP now have seemed to kind of, it seems like they're trying to appeal to more people, like not just, you
They've
know,
gone
not,
so
not,
status
yeah, not
to
just sort of libertarians who would vote conservative, but also like they're trying to appeal to basically disenfranchised Labour voters as well. I mean, that's how it looks, isn't it?
And they're going to have to break up as a result of this, because what UKIP have not done, what they should have done, they should have decided at that moment when loads and loads of old-fashioned socialists started to join them, what UKIP should have done if they wanted to make any kind of change to this country, what they should have done was had a sort of a three-point manifesto and no more. The 3 points should have been an end to political correctness in the form of anti-discrimination laws, an exit from the European Union, and a reform of immigration. That should have been their manifesto, nothing else. But they've made the mistake of deciding to put forward a manifesto like any other party. And that manifesto will include policies inevitably on the National Health Service, transport, education, and so on and so forth. And that's all very well and good when you have a party made up of people who largely agree. But now UKIP is, I think, probably quite evenly divided between socialists and libertarians. How on earth will they therefore come up with a policy on the National Health Service? Nigel Farage has repeatedly said he wants to abolish the NHS. More recently, he toned that down to say he wants an insurance-based system like that of Germany. More recently, he's toned that down even more to say he wants to have a full and frank debate about the future of the NHS. And the scorn with which she was treated for just saying that the last of those three shows that the direction UKIP has taken.
The thing about it is, in this country at least, I don't mean to sound pessimistic. I just think that the abolition of the NHS...
No, I mean, I can't...
Any politician with that on the platform, I mean, they're going to get laughed out.
Could you imagine a politician running on a platform of abolishing the NHS? I mean, and I don't even understand why, you know, like...
No, I can see now... Well, that's a totally different conversation, that is, obviously, than the NHS, though. It's an institution in this country. It provides, you know, there are so many things on both sides.
But, like, then some people might say, but then some people might make that argument about UKIP. I'm not saying I would, but some people might say, well, they're just putting things like, you know, all of this in because they have to.
Just to draw you in, and then they'll go, fuck you. Sorry, I didn't mean to swear so dramatically, but it's like, you know, it's like, why would they do that?
But you don't think it's that. You think there is a proper ideological split within the party just now.
Oh, definitely. I think I don't think they can put forward a coherent manifesto that they'll all agree on. And so they're going to have to just appeal to the lowest common denominator, which is a kind of state socialism, which is also largely quite nationalistic. That's
so
the
basically what we kind of have already.
What we kind of have already.
Wow, that's a shocker.
But a bit nationalistic and a bit more socialist,
Well, you think a bit more socialist?
Yeah, quite easily, because they're made up of, UKIP is now increasingly made up of people who used to vote for Labour in the 1970s and 80s when Britain was incredibly socialist.
Oh yeah, and look how well that went.
It turned out great.
But the UKIP thing is an interesting argument, and you know it's going to kind of, I think it's going to go on, in a big way. But what I was going to say is, you mentioned there, because every time we come up with UKIP, we get hit with the immigration chat. Tell us about, because we asked Sean and Gab the same thing, and I'd like your take on it. So, just like, what is your take on mass immigration in general?
Okay, this is one of the issues where me and Sean take completely different approaches, but somehow arrive at the same conclusion, largely. Sean will probably say something like, this is completely unprecedented in our history. We've seen nothing like it before. And it is being used against us to erode our historic liberties even further. And that's a pretty good argument. And I would endorse it. However, what I would also say is that the argument as put forward by Hans Hermann Hoppe against the idea of free immigration a priori, you know, abstracted from any empirical considerations, is much better. And so the simple argument is that the reason there exist borders, i.e. borders of Germany, borders of the UK, borders of France, is that the state has robbed people within these respective states have robbed people, and the money they have robbed or the resources they have robbed, they have used to finance or to construct public property, buildings, roads, etc. And these public facilities have therefore been created, financed, whatever, by the domestic tax-paying population. Mm-hmm. So there exist people within these borders who have a very good claim to these pieces of property. The mistake, therefore, on the part of the open border libertarians is to say that public property is unowned property. It isn't. Public property is not virgin territory. It isn't unused. It is used, and it has been financed by most of, or at least identifiable people within the borders of that country. So there is a definite reason why, say, a Chinese person does not have an ownership claim on the public property within the borders of the United Kingdom. And thus, as there exist identifiable people within the United Kingdom who have a very good claim on the public property, they, as owners, have the rights, of course, like any private owner, to exclude certain people and to decide who does come in and use that property. And so, of course, the way in which that is done now is, of course, imperfect, because it's done by the state. But the mistake is to say that because the present system is imperfect, that there would be no system at all for deciding who does and does not use public property. The mistake is to say that this is unowned property, which foreigners have just as much a right as anyone else to come in and homestead. That is a mistake. And that is why some control of immigration decided by certain people within the domestic population is preferable to mass open door immigration.
Yeah. And well, if we're talking about this just now, what's your view on this group, Pegida or whatever you want to pronounce it? What do you make of them?
I don't know much about them. It seems to me that they are, they're expressing perhaps some very legitimate concerns, but just not in a very nice way. I can't say anything more about them because I don't know about them.
It's like I've always said, you know, to people, you know, it's sort of, people, there's always going to be people that you don't like. They're just an arsehole and you don't need to talk to them. Like, if there's somebody that owns an establishment that I don't like, I don't use it. That's why.
The thing is, it's just because, like, there's been a, I don't think it's happened yet. I think it's planned. They're supposedly planning a march, this Pegida, we'll just call them that. Mob in Newcastle, I think it is. I believe it to be Newcastle, yeah. Which is interesting because we don't have like broadcast TV, but we managed to watch that show. What was that documentary
Angry
called?
Angry, White and Proud or something.
Yeah, Angry, White and Proud.
It was awful.
Yeah, did you see it?
No, but I've seen it advertised and that was enough.
Yeah, so we decided we were going to watch it, and it was, it's like it showed basically how with like the EDL and stuff having disbanded, you now have a lot of these splinter groups that are sort of all over the place, and they form kind of small factions and stuff. It just makes me wonder, you know, if like this is going to be the new sort of umbrella term for what people call the far right, you know. As much as we
people keep calling it that, and I hate the left and the right paradigm. We were talking about this earlier, Dan. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's so prevalent. It's like you have to be one or the other. Well, I hate that.
In Angry, White and Proud, they kept referring to the guys as right wing. Yeah, they kept saying right wing this, right wing that. Although these guys weren't...
they didn't have any kind of ideology.
They weren't talking economics, man. No. You know, they were walking about with flags, shouting at people, you know. And go on.
Well, yeah, there is a sense in which they are right wing, in the sense that they are reactionaries, I suppose. That they want... they probably want an all-white Britain, which was closer to the case, say, 100 years ago. And so in that sense, I suppose they're reactionaries. But certainly the means with which they want to achieve their ends are, I would say, distinctively left-wing, i.e. seizing property, coercive state violence, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, actually, I'd agree, absolutely. And it's so funny. Actually, Katie and I were talking about how it's hilarious how they make these all the time, and it's all, because I've seen a few of these. I saw another documentary like that was about like a young guy who was in the BNP. This was a few years ago. Can't remember his name. And they've made a few, but we always find it funny that they never make ones about, say, Antifa, you know, and Antifa are an extremely violent group, you know. So that's why.
To be left wing.
Yeah, we just.
I'm not saying they're right. I'm saying they're both wrong. But let's be honest, the left and the right both have their arseholes.
Oh, they both have their very extreme violent, you know, kind of street fighting sides.
Violent sects.
Yeah.
S-E-C-T-S, I think it's spelled, I think. I want to make that clear. My accent doesn't really help me.
Yeah, thank you for making that nice and clear.
Oh yeah, I wanted to be clear about that one.
But this brings up the case as well that, so we're having this like debate just now.
Is that what this is?
Well, it's not a debate, it's a conversation, right? We're having this conversation just now, but it seems like, don't you find on like mainstream media, as soon as like somebody wants to have a real debate about immigration or even, you know, like about race or whatever, it seems like straight away it's completely shut down. You're a racist. Case closed. Move
Sean
on.
Gap was shut down. On the BBC.
Apparently.
Oh, which one? Was that the one where his microphone was muted? Oh, that was hilarious. Yes, I think he was debating. It might not have been so broad a topic as immigration, but him and Yasmin Alibi Brown, are you familiar with the woman?
I've come across her once or twice.
Well, lucky her. But, but yeah. They were debating, and
I just got that. That was a sex joke. That was hilarious.
Indeed. Yes.
Took Kate a minute there. She got that.
That's slow, right?
And she said something absolutely outrageous, and he then turned it back on her and said, "Are you seriously saying that every white person wants to murder a black person?" And she said something to the effect of yes. And then, yeah.
Oh yeah, because we all have that, really, you know, it's built in when we're born or something like that. What a stupid argument.
Yeah, this is the problem, but like, because it seems like you find that like there's certain debates that seems like we're just not allowed to have, certain things that get shut down. You can't talk about them, you know, like I said, like immigration and things like that. And that's one thing that kind of then worries me about any time, you know, because it seems like the internet is the only place we have just now to kind of do this, you know, and with, I don't know.
I would be scared.
Think that the government would crack down on the internet?
Well, they've tried it, haven't they, in the guise of... in the guise of saving the kiddies. I think they want, they they've either done it or they want to do it. Something to do with banning child porn on the internet.
Yeah.
That, well, it probably is banned. I don't know. I wouldn't know. I have to emphasize this. Whenever we talk about something like this, we always have to emphasize, don't we? We would never look at this kind of stuff.
Oh, my God. Like, it's so funny that you say that, because I was thinking earlier, should I jump in and say, by the way, like, I don't harbor any horrible, racist, child porny, pedophile views. Like, it's not, I'm not a libertarian because I want to get away with things. I'm a libertarian because I believe this is the right way for things to be. It's so funny. Just when you said that, this is the official reading out disclaimer. Nobody here wants to hurt or harm anybody, and we would never try to.
Thank you for that.
Okay.
Keir?
Continue.
Yeah, but In the guise of saving the kiddies, there probably is some kind of regulation of the internet already out there, and there's certainly going to be some more planned. I don't know if it can be done feasibly. People still seem to be able to access dodgy stuff quite easily. And so I don't think there'll ever be any serious regulation of the internet. There'll certainly be attempts, but yes, the internet is very good, and I don't think it will be that we'll lose it in the foreseeable future.
I hope not. That's my worst fear.
I hope not. I know. We actually had a few internet-less days there.
Yeah, that's why we actually couldn't talk to. We were supposed to interview you last week, but
yes,
yes,
the phone lines went down, and Katie nearly lost her mind.
I nearly lost I lost my shit. That's the medical term for it. I lost my shit.
But then what happened was, I got a phone call, and it was a voicemail on my phone. It was some guy, because I have a thing in my phone that if I'm not there, if it cuts to voicemail, it cuts to me saying, unless I've been seized by the government, I'll give you a phone back. So I ended up getting a phone call from some guy going, excuse me, I'm agent something from the FBI, and I would like to speak to you about the phone lines in your house. And I thought, what the I didn't obviously think, but like, I thought I wasn't sure what was going on. I phoned back, it was a BT engineer
phoning about fixing the phone lines.
Oh man, you had me worried. I'm ultra paranoid now. We're going to start to wrap up here.
Yeah.
But Keir, you have been doing Libertarian Question Time.
Mm.
So why don't you tell us about that?
We had the idea of doing podcasts. I think it was in November. And so we only got around to doing it in January, naturally. And I think We couldn't think of any kind of way of recording it, and so we decided to do it on Hangout, on Google Hangout on Air. And the first three, I think, yes, the first three have been quite successful. We had Godfrey Bloom last time. He turned up 20 minutes, no, maybe not 20 minutes, 15 minutes late. but he turned up nonetheless. We pontificate on absolutely anything that the listeners or the commenters on the LA blog want us to, and yes, I haven't got round to any kind of catchphrase yet, but I've got to coin one, haven't I?
I think you do. We haven't even coined a catchphrase, not a proper catchphrase. We just kind of have a tagline. But no, that's the thing. I think there needs to be, you know, more UK-based libertarian media, because we do have a lot of good stuff, you know, coming out of the US, but it's different, you know. It's,
well, they have a different feel to it. They have a constitution.
They actually have guns.
Yeah, they have like gun laws. So when we're talking about like gun laws here,
yeah,
it's not even a start. It's a non-starter.
You
can't even start that debate in this country.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the majority of people want to crack down on the already extremely cracked down. But you know what? This is for another time. I'm jumping into a totally
into other conversations, Katie. Keir, you just can't help yourself.
Thank you so much for coming onto the show today.
You're very welcome.
Yes, thank you. And you also, tell us where we can find you online.
You can find me online at thelibertarianalliance.com, which is all one word, The Libertarian Alliance.
We will link it up, yeah.
Yes, and that's about it, I think.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome again.